familiar with Blazers. Blazers should be like any other AGN, but just have a jet, and the jet is pointed towards our line of sight. It turns out that that orientation is very important and gives Blazers very special properties and very unique properties that really set them aside from all the other AGN that we know of, and it really makes them very, very bright and very variable objects that we see across the electromagnetic spectrum. And you can see example here of M87, how it looks like on in different wavelengths, from radio to the left to optical and X-rays in the middle, and X-rays and gamma rays to the right. Of course, M87 is not really a blazar, but it's not a radio galaxy either. Is something in between, something in the blazar lingo we call a misaligned AGN. And that is why we can see this, all this beautiful structure. Typically, blazars would just look like point sources, no matter, you know, the instrument or the wavelength. But according to the, you know, AGN unification, everything that applies to M87 should also apply to blazars as well. So what we think is going on is that you have your, you know, standard AGNs or black hole and the accretion disk, and then you launch the jet. The jet is not very fast in the beginning, but it accelerates as it moves away from the black hole. It goes through the broadline region, and about parsec scales, it will reach its terminal velocity to a place we call the core of the jet. Now, this is very different from what you would call the core of the jet in radio galaxies, which is most likely the base of the jet. In blazars, that is probably some standing shock, or many believe it's a recollimation shock of the flow because of changes in the external pressure gradient of pressure gradient of the external medium. What we do know is that there's a lot of particle acceleration and high energy emission there. And after that, the jet can stay with the same velocity, it can decelerate, but it will certainly be dominated more and more by radio emission, which is going to be the focus of my talk. But for completeness, this is what the spectral energy distribution of blazars looks like. And as you can see, there are not a lot of features. It's just the, you know, two broad humps. The first one, from radio to X-rays, is from singleton radiation from relative excited electrons that are accelerated in the magnetic field of the jet. The second one, that goes from X-rays to TV gamma rays, that is something we don't really know the origin of, but we have two competing models. One is what we call leptonic. This is where you have electrons in your jet, and the electrons will, as they propagate, they see some target photon field that could be from the jet itself. Or it could be some external source like the accretion disk or the broadline region, or even the dusty torus, and then they will upscatter those photons to higher energies. The other family of processes in the model, the prohadronic, where now you have protons in your jet, and the protons will make synchrotron, or they will interact with other protons and photons, produce pions, and pions will decay to secondary particles and gamma rays. Now, like anything else that lives in moderate to high redshift, we expect blazars to be gravitationally lensed. And we have already examples of strong lensing in blazars. I'm showing you two sources that are known. They appear usually like the standard twin quasar, which you can see here in this top right, where these are the contours from the radio observations that are found mostly, and then the rest is kind of the model of the lens. Now, the strong lens blazars have been kind of a trendy thing lately, and there's a lot of interest in the gamma ray community because, of course, there is no hope ever to resolve the two images with gamma ray instruments. But because They're both included in the PSF. If you have flares in the blazar, then that will appear as the two-peak structure, which you see down here. So basically, each image of the blazar will give you one flare, and then you can get a very precise measurement of the time delay between the images. And if you have some idea about the source on the lens, then you can use that to study gamma ray processes to constrain the emission region and generally improve the angular resolution of your gamma ray instrument by basically orders of magnitude. So there's been a lot of interest in that lately. As for the microlensing signatures, that's a whole different story. We don't really have any good cases so far. And one of the major reasons is blazar variability. The blazar is so variable that anything and that could mimic, well, anything that looked like microlensing could be easily mimicked by other processes or swamped completely because of the red noise processes that are going on. But in the Owens Valley Radio Observatory laser program, we try to study that variability and try to understand the underlying processes. The program started in 2008 at 15 gigahertz using a 40 meter telescope at the Owens Valley Observatory. And it was all because of the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, which was launched at the same time. And we started off with a sample of about 1,100 sources then became much more because as Fermi detected new gamma ray emitters, we kind of accreted more sources. So by 2021, we had about 1,800 sources in a sample that were observed about with a cadence of about twice per week. So every 3 days, we would get an observation of the source, and you can see kind of the light curve, one of the light curves there, and how fast variability can be, even in radio. I mean, this is a typical misconception that radio is not variable or not as variable as other wavelengths. That is definitely not true for blazars. So at a cadence of twice per week, you can really kind of sample the light curve nicely, and you can really see kind of all the variability that you've actually missed if you had much lower cadence. And in fact, back in 2021, we had more than an order of magnitude higher cadence than any other blazar survey in radio out there. Since 2021, we changed our scope a little bit. So we are focusing on multi-messenger astronomy now. So basically the association between neutrinos and blazars, and also gravitational waves that could be coming from supermassive black hole binary sources. And we have also increased our sample by a factor of 3. So it's now 5,500 sources. And of course, our cadence had to be reduced a bit. So we're now looking at the sources roughly every 10 days. So blazar variability is kind of unique to every source. And we have a lot of different, there's a very high level of diversity among variability patterns. And you can see like the very fast variability that I showed you earlier, to a few examples here where there is, no variability, very slow variability, or you have this gigantic 10 Jansky flares that can happen. Every blazar is really, really unique in that sense. And it's really complicated, our analysis and our understanding of the population in general. I will focus on a particular source, which is called PKS 1413 plus 135. This is an extra peculiar blazar, if I might say. And one of the reasons is that's the only blazar we know that seems to be in a spiral galaxy. All the other blazars are in ellipticals. So then, you have to wonder why, if you have, thousands of blazars, why is that source so special and it's in a spiral galaxy? At some point, we have to wonder how does the blazar know which host galaxy it's in to choose the ellipticals? But that's a whole different story, which I'm not going to even touch. But it's a nearby source, point two. And there are also other peculiar features. Like, for example, it seems to be kind of skewered, which a much higher neutral hydrogen column density than any galactic value can account for. And there is also seems to be a slight displacement of the AGN from the center of the host galaxy. So in fact, this had been suspected of being a background source to a spiral galaxy since very early in the 90s, but there hasn't been really concrete proof for that. In a sense, we discovered the source independently, meaning that we did not know about these properties until the source caught our attention and we started kind of looking in the literature to see if anybody has studied it. And what caught our attention, specifically caught the attention of a postdoc at Caltech called Harish Vedantham, who noticed, he was looking for extreme scattering events. And he noticed this U-shaped dips you see here. So the initial hypothesis was this was an extreme scattering event, had nothing to do with gravitational lensing. So then Harish gathered up 20 years worth of data from different observatories in different frequencies. The overall data are what you see here in black. And then he found out that, in fact, there are other U-shaped events in the archival data, but also he saw that the across different frequencies, these U-shaped events seem to be roughly achromatic, which would argue very strongly against the extreme scattering event interpretation. Now, they're not exactly, they call them symmetric achromatic variability, but they're not exactly achromatic. And in fact, you wouldn't really expect them, expect these events to be achromatic. But there has to be some sort of lensing, even if it's not plasma lensing, so it has to be some sort of gravitational lensing. And this is one of the reasons. You can ignore the lines for now, just focus on the points there. So the black dots are the over data as observed. The gray points and the open circles are the same data with the time reversed. So we flipped kind of the event, and you can see how incredibly symmetric that U-shape is. And blazars just don't do that. There is no reason why random, very stochastic variability would just give you a perfectly symmetric event. So with that in mind, they considered four different possibilities. One is that you have the blazar in the spiral galaxy, and then you have some lensing, some lens in our own galaxy. Now, because the events last for about a year, that would mean that there is something that's more than 10 to the 6 solar masses, so more than Sagittarius, heavier than Sagittarius A star, just floating in the spiral arms. So that seemed a little bit unlikely. There is the other possibility is that the blazar is still in the spiral, but there is another galaxy or something else between us and the blazar. So they took a spectrum from Keck, and then they basically saw the standard emission lines and what they expected from a spiral galaxy. And there is no evidence that there's anything in between. Of course, there could be some very faint dwarf galaxy that kind of evaded our detection, but that seems also a little bit unlikely. So there are two kind of possibilities they run with. One is that you have the blazar is in the spiral, but there is a lens in the host galaxy of the blazar, or that you have the blazar be a background source to a spiral galaxy. So with, again, that in mind, Harish did a very simple binary model with external convergence here, and just, I wouldn't say fit, because this is not the proper fit. It was more like, chi by I, as they say, but it seems to match the observations kind of very nicely. And if you consider the two possibilities, it's easier to do this and reproduce the light curves with the background source hypothesis. But they left it at that. Of course, we couldn't just drop it. So then in 2021, we published a paper where we looked at the full multi-wavelength properties of the source and the host and the jet and its orientation, and we tried to understand what's going on. And one of the very peculiar results in our analysis is basically that if the blazar is in the spiral galaxy, that means that the jet is near parallel to the galactic plane of its host, which that would mean that it's another, you know, very unique feature, because every other radio source we know about, not just blazars, every other radio source has its jet within, you know, 20 to 30 degrees from the plane normal. So that would be kind of a really unique feature. So now you have to accept that the jet is, you know, unique and perpendicular to anything else. And you also have to accept that this is the only source in the universe that is a blazar in a spiral galaxy. So there are a few uncomfortable facts that, you know, go with that interpretation. So it's much more likely that we're really looking at the background source, which is what you see on the right, where there is a blazar that is somewhere between 0.247 and 0.5 Z. This is because if it was further out, we would have seen strong lensing images in the VLBI maps. So we can kind of constrain the distance with that. And then that blazar is just shooting components down the jet. And then it's aligned just right with the Seyfert galaxy and a 10 to the 4 roughly solar mass lens in there. There have been other papers with evidence that there is a giant molecular cloud in between, and that will match very nicely kind of also the mass and the properties. But as the jet shoots down components, that will cross the caustics of the lens, and that will give you the U-shaped events that we see from Earth. So everything kind of matches nicely, and it makes, I think, a very solid prediction that if that's true, then all the U-shaped events that we see that are in fact gravitational lensing could be explained by an unvarying lens model that you just, you know, shoot components, or imagine shooting rays with a different, you know, velocity and an impact factor, and you should be able to reproduce all your lensing, or the lensing event you see in your light curve. And this is what we attempted to do with Lawrence Pearson, who's a graduate student at Stanford. Now we got 40 years worth of data, and we identified by eye five different U-shaped events. The first two were already included in the previous papers. So using those five, we try to build a model where we can actually fit that the lensing signatures and recover the parameters. And Lawrence did a really fantastic job into making a proper MCMC fitting tool that will allow us to do that. And he was really so good at it, actually, that he it's so versatile that you can fit either multiple frequencies together in the same event, as you see on the left, but also you can, you know, fit multiple lensing events in different frequencies, as you see on the right. So we played a lot with it, and we used many different configurations where we either fit individual events, or, you know, we fit combinations, or altogether multiple frequencies, what have you. And we basically came to the same conclusions that we can recover the same parameters for the lens for four out of the five events that we had identified. The one that's have named there SAV3, you see with the hatched shaded area, that the U shape is not very symmetric The fit of the data is bad and consistently was giving us different parameters than all the other four. So we think that this is most likely some random blazar variability and not a real lensing event. But the other four events gave us consistent parameters no matter how we played around with it. And we were also challenged by one of our co-authors to make a prediction. So I just ran a very simple Lobscargo periodogram that you see on the top, and I just grabbed the period of the highest peak. And then if you just, that's about 987, I think, days. And then if you consider that SAV1 that you see here, that's T equals zero, then you can plot out every time that we should be seeing an SAV event. And what is really remarkable is that you managed to hit all three other events. That's like, you know, SAV2, 4, and 5, and it completely misses SAV3, which is the one that we deem that it's not a real lensing event, is more likely blazar variability, which is really crazy if you think about it. And it also helped us achieve our objective of making a prediction that the next event will be around in August of 2022. So just 2 months from now. Of course, I am willing to bet one of the bottle of the fine wines that you're enjoying there without me that we're not gonna see an SAV event. I would be very surprised if that happened exactly as in our prediction. I think this is more likely some sort of weird coincidence or just another example of how red noise variability can just trick you. But it's good to have predictions, and it's always kind of fun to think about those things. So just to summarize, I think we now have very very strong evidence that PKS4015 is in fact a background blazar to a Seyfert galaxy. And if this is true, it would really be an unprecedented opportunity to study the 3D structure of the jets in exquisite angular resolution. It's still in our sample, so it's part of the 5,500 sources. So we're gonna know if there's another event in August, but as I said, you know, I would not hold my breath for it. And yeah, we now think it's about 1 in 2,000 sources, simply because we were observing 1,800 and we found one. So this is really statistics of one, which don't really, numbers don't really, you know, matter. But if you're asking if this is unique, I would argue no. I find it unlikely that it's the only one in the universe that does that. It's more probable that there are others out there. It's just blazar variability is really masking those signatures. So we really need to either have very long light curves. So long-term monitoring and consistent long-term monitoring is very important. Or we need to have a very large number of sources just to, you know, improve our chances of detecting these events. And I think we are very lucky because both LSST and CMBS4 are just around the corner, and they will do exactly what we want, you know, like monitor a very large number of sources in multiple frequencies that will really give us the ideal data set to study microlensing in blazars, but I'm sure in AGN in general. And of course, as I've mentioned, the MCMC package Lawrence made is really fantastic, and it lets you fit basically any microlensing event. It doesn't have to be related to blazars or AGN. The important feature that is not included in the other fitting packages is the external shear and external convergence, which is really relevant to extragalactic kind of microlensing. So that's, I think, a very, very important addition. And it is now included in the MuLens model, which is the standard, very easy to use kind of Python package that a lot of people are using. So yeah, if you're interested in that, please go check it out. So I'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Yanis. So now I open the talk for questions. First from online participants, we have some questions. I can see that we have from online participants from the wall. George.
Well, thank you for this very nice talk. I wanted to ask, what are the main challenges for finding the the first redshift for the source?
So what are the, okay, I'm having a bit of hard trouble hearing, but if I hear you correctly, you said, what are the challenges of finding the redshift of the source?
Yes, the redshift of the source. Is it because it's completely blocked and dominated by the interfering galaxy, interfering cipher galaxy in between, or is...
So we don't find any lines other than, I went too far, sorry. Yeah, should be here. So we don't find any lines related to other than what we expect from a Seyfert galaxy. This is because of the obscuration. Like if you look at the, at least that's our interpretation, right? That anything will have to go through the entire galaxy. And we think that's why we don't see anything, and we use Keck, right? It's not like a small telescope. The uncertainty we have in the redshift, this is related to a lot of unknown parameters, or at least kind of a range of unknown parameters that we have that conspire to give a big range. But the upper limit comes from the fact that we should, if it's further out, we should see the strong lensing images in the VLBI. So that puts kind of an upper limit. But how far out from the spiral galaxy, that's a bit uncertain.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, more questions? If not, I have really one question. You showed the micro lensing event is some kind, if I understood well, some kind of absorption that we can see. Yes or no?
Because the micro lensing, no, it should be just
in. You showed the slide with the micro lensing event.
Oh, this one or the ones before?
Yes, this one. So, what is on why?
Axis is flux, or? Yeah, that's flux, and then that's the y-axis is flux, the x-axis is time, and you basically have a binary lens that has some external convergence and shear.
I see, this is binary lens,
yes? Yes, it's a binary lens. So we tested different models for the lens, especially we tested also some elliptical kind of models, but those create a different shape for the lensing. So that will be, so the elliptical models create a slow rise, fast rise, slow decay, slow rise, fast decay. That's what they call a crater model. And this is more of a, what they call a volcano, which is the slow rise, fast decay, fast rise, slow decay. Kind of.
Okay.
So the binary model is simply the easiest and simplest kind of model that will has enough complexity to create this kind of U shape. We're not claiming it's the only possibility, right? It's just the Occam's razor, just the simplest thing that will get the job done.
So might be strange idea to have, because if I understood that you have a galaxy that is between us and the blazar, yes?
Yes.
And then you might have some kind of strong lensing, but very that it is not so hard and that you can resolve two sources, you know. And then if you have one micro lensing, you will have the similar, even the same shape of micro lens. You know, simply this is good idea to have binary lens. It means you have micro lens that is binary, that is crossing, but also you can have two sources lens that they are almost as one and you cannot not resolve, and then you can have single micro lens that will make two peaks. It's something so that might be interesting to consider such situation.
I think you're talking about this case where you just cannot resolve the two spots and you get the...
But you have that the source is not, that the distances between lenses is very, very small. And you have something as millilensing, you know, not macro, but millilensing, that they are very, very, very close to each other. And then if you have lensing by single micro lens, you will have a similar profile like this.
Okay.
So it's something that you may consider as a working idea in this case. Because
yeah, definitely. That's
between observer and the source.
Yeah, as I said, we're not claiming that the binary model is the only possibility to explain that. But yeah, that's a good point.
You can model using, I think, George modeled some macro lensing, taking this redshift of phasor, and redshift of the galaxy, and approximately you can take mass of galaxy and see how much will be distances between two images. They can be, in some cases, with cosmological parameters, that can be very, very close to each other, that you cannot resolve it. And then if you have single micro lens, then you can have the same effect. That is my comment.
Well, if you have something ready to be applied, I'll be happy to, work with you.
You can ask George if you can model taking the redshift of the Sapir 2 galaxy and the laser to see approximately how much is distance between images, between two images.
Yeah, that's why I posed the first question. Only get the range of parameters
below
a certain redshift of the source of the blazer. But we can definitely, if the blazer redshift is between 0.2 and 0.5, I guess that we could definitely get some estimates what would be the source separation for that range and the standard cosmological parameters, for example, for the flat universe.
Could you calculate it and send us?
Yeah.
You understand me? Okay, then you make a deal. Okay.
Awesome.
Do we have more questions for Yanis? Because I cannot see Sasha Zakharov. Could you see her? Probably he has problems, so we have time. In any case, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Yanis.
Thank you.
Sasha?
Yes. Somebody called guest.
Somebody called guest. Sasha, are you present online? I'm not sure. Might be some technical problem. In any case, I will contact Alexander Zakharov to see if he
has now a technical problem to be later on, or